qualities. Oh, see. Is there anyone not here? Please put your hand up. So no one put their hand up, so who wants to be here? Very good. Very good. Is anyone left outside who are waiting for to come in? Or are there most people are here now? Yeah. I think it looks like it. Okay. Oh no. Can you hear the sound? Is that loud enough? Very good. So again, welcome to the first talk of this meditation retreat here. This place was specially designed as a retreat center. It's not a hotel. It's not sort of a camp. It is a retreat center. So have nice food, nice facilities here, and hopefully that you are warm enough and well enough fed here. So once we look after the physical part of your well-being, again, if you're too cold, there's always many blankets. We have a couple of people who are wearing the blankets. Susan, would you like to stand up to model the latest fashion meditation blanket? So these are just nice little shawls you can put on around you in case you get a bit too cold. But hopefully, because, you know, for me, this is just perfect temperature, just like this. But for many of you who come over from Hong Kong and from Indonesia, where it's much warmer. So if you want to turn the aircon on or turn it up afterwards, please go and ask Christina. And then she can turn it up, make it comfortable for you. So how is it so far? Is it too cold for you or too hot for you? It's good, okay. Very good. If it gets too hot, you find that during the meditation, people are falling asleep because the heat tends to get you a little bit more dozy. Too cold, you get a bit too stressed. So we try and find a middle way so it's not too hot and not too cold. So just sometimes you can do that with clothes and, you know, put some more clothes on. If it's too hot, you can take some clothes off, but not too many clothes off, please. I'm a very sensitive monk. And find that nice, comfortable middle way. Number two is sitting on the floor. You don't have to sit on the floor. Oh, please find a nice chair. All the chairs are all stacked up, but you can take the chairs out and just sit on the chairs. The chairs are also very comfortable for you to sit on. Oh, for those, very good, excellent, we've got some chair people. The chairs to sit on, it means that your body can relax and doesn't feel any or too much pain or discomfort. So I'm very happy if people will, you know, use those chairs. Sometimes you can alternate between the chair and the floor. Or like, no one's done this yet, but, you know, usually happens. Or just sitting on the floor, but leaning against the wall. Which, you know, it's okay. That makes you reasonably comfortable. And if you can do that, it means that your body can get relaxed and at ease. Even the symbolism of relaxing. As I said, I think the first day yesterday, because some people came early, that you can imagine, visualize a string, especially a guitar string, which is stretched really tight. Or the other simile which I used was like the skin of a drum. If that skin of the drum is really stretched tight, then you hit it and it makes a very loud sound. It's tense. So little things get amplified. A little ache, a little pain, a thought, or a sound. When you're very tense, a small thing becomes very huge. But when you're relaxed, when you don't wear things tightly, then things happen and you don't get that sort of reverberation. I remember just giving a talk at an executive conference here in Perth, and afterwards one of the executives, they took me aside and they said, you know, I was brought up in a Catholic convent with nuns. And he said, I look at you and I look at those Catholic nuns, which I used to be taught by. And those Catholic nuns were so tight. Every part of their clothing was belted up, was buttoned up. Everything was just so compressed and tight. And just like their teaching, you had to do this, you had to do that. It was so disciplined, so fierce, and I hated it. And I look at you, Ajahn Brahm. There's nothing buttoned up at all. Everything is loose and falling off. And he said, that's the difference. And I thought, that's a very good perception to understand. So really relax. You button up. It gets so tight sometimes inside of you. So just learn how to relax. So you have the chairs if you need to sit on the chairs. The floor if you want to sit on the floor. We've got the cushions. And I just noticed coming in here, there's still lots of cushions left. So there's still more cushions. And see, as the weekend or the week goes, see if you can rise higher and higher. Another cushion up here, a cushion up there, a cushion somewhere else. But the point is to make the body relaxed. Because when the body is relaxed, then actually it feels very, very happy and very pleasant. If you go to hospitals, now when you go to hospitals, they don't put you on just wooden benches. You have nice soft pillows and soft mattresses and a little thing by the side of your bed which you can actually move it up and move it down, move it this way and move it that way. Even they have in the hospitals these little bed pans. And I thought they'd be very useful in a meditation retreat. So, you know, if you really need to go to the toilet, but you're just about to get enlightened, and getting up will make it sort of disturb the meditation, you get the bed pad out. And so you can do your business and you haven't moved your posture, so much more likely to get enlightened. No, we can't do that. We haven't done it yet. It's amazing. Have you noticed sometimes all these things you suggest out of fun, they eventually happen. Anyway, back to making yourself comfortable. So it's an important part because then we don't get so tight inside of ourselves. We relax. And when you relax, you find that when you really relax, you can go to sleep well at night, you're more peaceful, more happy. In hospitals, you have to relax to get better. It's the same to get the body relaxed and get the mind to be relaxed. It's the same principle. Stop pulling and pushing the body. Stop forcing it. So it's the same when you're meditating. Sometimes people have all these ideas of how they should meditate. And they find they can't do any of them. So there is this one lovely way of meditating, which it came from one of those stories in those books which I wrote, and that particular story was the story of the old Emperor's Three Questions story. And that was, again, for those of you who don't remember that story, it came from Leo Tolstoy. And I remember reading that story when I was a student at university. And it was just a very wonderful story which I've never forgot, both in life, but also used it to develop deeper and easier meditation. And the Emperor's Three Questions story was, you know, when is the most important time? Who is the most important person and what's the most important thing to do? That was the story. And the answers, which I hope you all know by now, number of times I've taught this, if you don't remember this story and you've been to my talks and retreats in Indonesia and Hong Kong many times, I think you should get checked out for dementia. You must be forgetting things. So the Emperor's Three Stories question, when is the most important time? Of course, when I read that, you know, the idea of Eckhart Tolle and the power of now and Buddhism and mindfulness, you know, people didn't even know how to spell mindfulness in those days. But we all know now, when is the most important time? And the answer is lunchtime. Only a couple of hours to go. Which, of course, is wrong. But many people on the retreat think, oh, yeah. But the most important time is right now. It's the only time you have. Everything else is fantasies and dreams, memories, projections, and it's not true. Even how many times you've had arguments with someone, who did what, who said what, and we argue with each other about the past so much. We both think we're right. Only one person can be right, but there's no way of finding out. So, good example of that. When you came in here, you left your shoes outside. Which side of the door did you leave the shoes? Was it to the left or to the right? Was it the back or the front? Where did you leave your shoes? Do you remember? Are you sure? When you go out, we'll check it again. Because I did ask Stephen to jumble up the shoes. You know, we always think we're right. How many times have you gone to a shopping mall, parked your car, and gone back, it's stolen? Like that. One of the first people who came to this, before even Jhana Grove was purchased, Bodhinyana Monastery, he came to this monastery just for a couple of months, I think, just, you know, helping out to build the place. And he wasn't married, he didn't have any family, and the only thing he had was a Harley Davidson motorbike. And he loved his motorbike, not because it was like a status symbol, but it allowed him to have freedom. Whenever he just wanted, okay, I've had enough of the monastery for now, he'd get on his bike and he'd just go, you know, wherever the fancy took him. And so he'd travel all around Australia, go to spiritual communities. He was very helpful here because he could do some work, do some cooking for us. You know, and he was, I don't know if he was a Buddhist, but, you know, a very spiritual person. And when he had enough, off he went in his Harley. And after he had actually told me a couple of stories, I'll make the other story later when it doesn't fit. And on this particular story, he said he was going doing some shopping in some big shopping mall in Sydney. And he parked his Harley in the car park, went to get his shopping, and then when he came back, it had been stolen. The only thing of value he had in his life had been stolen. And he put down his shopping bags, and he realized that, you know, from that moment his life must change. The one thing which gave him freedom, the one thing which he owned which was worth something, had been taken by somebody else. But because, you know, he'd learned, you know, the Dhamma, learned some teachings, he thought to himself, it's like the death of a loved one. He said, well, I've had some wonderful times with this Harley. I've got some great memories, but, you know, nothing lasts forever. So my life has to change now. Those days of freedom, riding around Australia in my Harley Davidson, is now over. He actually let it go. And he thought to himself, whoever has taken that Harley Davidson, I hope they have as much fun and pleasure and freedom as I had. You know, and he actually let it go. And because he told me about this, he wrote this letter to me and said how amazed and impressed he was that he could let something go like that. Now, even though that he was so attached to it, it gave him so much pleasure. It is like losing someone who's very close to you, a dear relation. And when he felt just this sense of, oh, this Dharma actually really works, you lose something and, you know, you feel at peace with it. It was only after he came to that recollection and that understanding of the Dharma, it's only then that he realized he was in the wrong level of the car park. And of course, he went down the level. It looked exactly the same. And there was his Harley, untouched. It's a wonderful way of just letting go of stuff. And he could actually do it. So, now with us, you know, when we learn how to let go, life is very relaxing and very easy. So, even with our body, we learn how to relax. And with our mind, because he forgot where he put it. It looked the same. You know you put your shoes somewhere outside, but you don't know exactly where. Because it's not that important. So a lot of our memories are just not all that accurate. So, we don't need to know. Because the shoes are out there anyway. And it doesn't matter because, you know, we're Buddhists, we share. So if you go outside, look at your shoes, and then I haven't worn these for too long. I'm going to wear some other shoes today. You can actually change. Yeah. You know, over at our centre, over in Nolamara Centre, on a Friday night, people would leave their shoes outside, and they go to the meditation. And when they came out afterwards, every week, you know, some lady had lost a shoe. Only one shoe. And the other one was there. But the other one, no, she waited, everybody left, and just one shoe had left, was disappeared. And we really thought, you know, I was looking to see if there's anyone here, it was women's shoes, so any woman with only one leg. She must be the thief. And for weeks that went on. And we looked and looked, and we don't know. It was just, it was strange. Now, who would steal one shoe and not other shoes? And eventually, you know, we found the solution. It was one of the neighbors. She cleaned out the dog kennel, and the dog kennel was full of shoes. The dog next door had got into the habit of going over to the temple every time everyone was meditating there, and it would sniff, sniff it. That's the one I want. It would take it into the dog kennel and hide it there, and the kennel was full of its trophy shoes, and it could only take one at a time in its mouth, and that's why only one was left for the time. But anyway, so the past, you don't know exactly what happened and why. And the future, we don't know what's going to happen and why. So in this meditation, don't let your mind be pulled on both ends. The past dragging you. You can feel the tension, all that unfinished business, all that stuff, that anger, that upset, being mistreated, not being given a fair chance, all that stuff in the past pulls you this way. And all the craving, the wanting, the desires of the future pulls you this way. And so your poor brain is being stretched. It's a surprise it doesn't come out of your ears. It just goes, oh, you're so stretched, so much tension inside. So what do we do? Ah, let go of the past. Who knows? It might have happened, it might not have happened. Who knows why these things happen? Who would have ever guessed it was a dog was the thief? So you just let the past go. As the future, you don't know what is going to happen. Who would have ever thought that Donald Trump would be the president of the United States? Did you see that one coming? No. And I don't know if you... maybe a while I've said this about the assassination attempt on Donald Trump. Did you hear about that? Really? How many watching the news? There was assassination attempt against Donald Trump. While he was giving a talk or a speech or whatever, somebody stood up with a gun. An assassin pointed at Donald Trump. And the Secret Service agent shouted out, "Donald, duck!" And just like you, the assassin burst out laughing. Could pull the trigger and save his life. You're very nice coming here, Tony. So, well, it's not Tony, isn't it? It's Tony, yeah. Your name, yeah. Andy, that's even better. Because I'm going to invite you give you a free ticket every retreat, because your laughter, at least somebody laughs at my jokes. And it makes me feel much better, so thank you very much. But anyway, so we don't know what might happen in the future. So because of that, we don't worry about anything. Usually just the most unexpected things occur. What we never thought would happen usually does happen. And some of it is unpleasant stuff, but most of it is very pleasant stuff. How many of you thought you would be sitting here, sort of in the middle of winter, on a meditation retreat, with no TV, with bad internet reception, not being able to eat in the afternoon or evening or night time, listening to a Kuai Lo. But, you know, here we are. Life is just so sort of unexpected. And it's wonderful it's like that, because it means worrying. All the things you ever worry about, how many of them are worth worrying about? Does it make any difference? All the worry. That's why it was one of the great American philosophers. Do you follow philosophy? I'm sure you may have heard of this, because he's a very, very famous philosopher called Snoopy. These are the real philosophers. You can actually understand what they say. This philosopher, Snoopy the dog, some of his favorite sayings were that worrying about the future does not stop bad things happening. They happen anyway. But worrying about the future stops you enjoying the present. So you don't enjoy the present moment. You're not having a sense of it. And it's usually the case that if you worry about bad things happening, they're usually more likely to happen. So let it happen, whatever happens. We'll deal with that later on. And it's less likely to occur. Oh, what was that other little story about that fear of the future? That was, you know, when I was a lay person, I've been a monk now almost 44 years. And so when I was a lay person, to see anything remotely connected to Buddhism was just really hard. And the only show on the TV at the time, which was sort of Buddhist, was that TV show Kung Fu. And when I told my friends, I was just watching Kung Fu, he said, "That Buddhist, that was a Buddhist monk. Why is it so violent every week?" It's a good point. One of the reasons is because people wouldn't watch the TV if it wasn't have some violence in it. So that's why that, you know, that my books continue to be good bestsellers. And the one of the first books, the Opening the Door of Your Heart book, that somebody photographed, and it was on the Buddhist blogs and stuff, that Sarah Jessica Parker, Sarah Jessica Parker, she's an American actress. She was seen in a coffee shop reading my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart. And that she was, I think, a star of Sex in the City. Is that right? And you know that. How do you know that?
I'm telling your wife. How does Andrew Brum know that? More to the point. Because somebody told me. But apparently, so as soon as I saw that, I thought, wow, this very famous TV show, and this lead actress, she's the lead actress, but anyway, she is reading my book. And I thought, just what fantasies one thought to the other. I thought, maybe she'd invite me onto her show. Special episode, Sex and the City, starring Ajahn Brahm. And I thought, how would that work out? So I thought, can't have any violence, can't have any sex, can't have any revealing clothing. So we'd actually have to change the episode to no sex in the monastery. Would anyone watch that? So there isn't that violence and stuff in the Kung Fu, which is to make it sort of more attractive to the audiences. But they did have some wonderful little scenes. And the one I remember, it was all about just, what happens when you worry about the future. And that was the, I don't know if you ever saw this, but there was the blind master. That is very, very wise master. And he took the little disciple, the novice monk, Grasshopper. And he said, Grasshopper, now is the time for you to actually do the next part of your training. And he took him into this darkened room, usually kept locked. And young novices always wonder, what was actually kept in there? And so he opened up the door and took this little novice inside. And because the master was blind, he asked, little grasshopper, what do you see? And he went close, and it was like an indoor swimming pool. He said, I see there's a pool in here, an inside pool. He said, go a bit closer. What can you see on the bottom? But be careful. And he went close to the edge. And of course, in my lounge room somewhere in England, I was there watching as well. This was interesting. What was this? And little grasshopper peeked on the edge and said, there's bones down there, master. There's bones. Human bones. Lots of them. And the master said, because he was blind, little grasshopper, those are bones of little novices like you who fell in. See that? That's not water. That is very concentrated, corrosive hydrochloric acid. And of course, as soon as they said that, little grasshopper stepped away from the edge of the pool. And I don't know why the psychology of this is, but even I, looking in the TV in the lounge room, I moved back as well. It was scary. He said, what else do you see, little grasshopper? He said, I see a plank of wood stretching from one edge of the pool to the other edge, crossing the pool. Yes, said the master. 1 week from today, you have to do a test which every novice has to pass. You have to walk across that pool of deadly, corrosive, burning, concentrated acid from one side to the other. And if you fall in, there will be more bones on the bottom of that pool of acid.
yours. And poor little grasshopper was scared. And so was I. But, said the master, we've got 1 whole week for you to train. You don't have to do anything else. No duties, just balancing. And so he took him outside, and there was another plank of wood, exactly the same size and length, but only put on 2 bricks. Now, practice your balancing. And so, little grasshopper, every morning, afternoon, and just even one day, he could balance no problem at all. Sometimes he would dance up there, sometimes he would hop one-legged. I never saw him do the kangaroo hop, because they didn't know kangaroos in that part of wherever it was. But anyway, after 1 week, he could balance so easily. And then came the time when he had to do the real test. You ever know what it's like? You know, when you can do your sort of examinations at school or university. You know, you could do your driving test or whatever else you need a test for. You know, it's really easy, but when it's a big test, people, they just cramp up, they freeze, and they just fail every time. Because it's the real thing. And so this time, he told the grasshopper in the room over the real acid, get on the end of the plank of wood. And you can see the little grasshopper was really scared. Because this one little slip, and it'd be burning in acid. And on the end of the plank, little grasshopper. And you can imagine that a plank of wood, the same size, the same length, the same width, on 2 bricks in a courtyard, is much, much shorter when it's the same size over acid. That plank seemed to go on forever. Walk. The little grasshopper started walking. Walking, step, you could see it was unsteady. No dancing, no kangaroo hop now. This was serious. And you could see that his knees started to get weak. You know, when you're walking, you start to shake a little bit. He started to shake a little bit. And then it looked like he was beginning to sway. And he hadn't got even halfway over the acid yet. It looked like he was going to fall in. That's what it looked like. You know what happened? Had a break for the ads. The commercial break. Do they still have that these days? It's really mean, isn't it? Because you don't want to know what happened. Anyway, this stupid toothpaste. This toothpaste makes you really attractive to girls. This car. You know, you haven't sort of arrived yet until you get this old car. Well, I don't know what advertisements they have all these days. But anyway, I had to wait until the advertisement was finished. And then when the advertisement was back in this really scary room with little grasshopper on this narrow plank walking across. They always go back a few seconds. And then it looked like he started to lose his balance. His legs started to get weak. He started to shake. He started to sway. And he fell in. Little grasshopper fell into the acid. Like, oh my goodness, this is not supposed to happen. What's going to happen next? And he was splashing around in the acid. And he wasn't burnt. And the great master was laughing his head off. So much for compassion. There is your disciple who's being consumed by acid and you're just laughing. And realized you'd make a very good master, Andy. But he was just splashing around. It wasn't sort of burning him. And that's where the master said, little grasshopper, it's only water. It's not acid. And the bones down there, it's what we call these days special effects. Just to convince you. And that's when the master said this wonderful little statement. He said, "Why did you fall in, little grasshopper? It was fear pushed you in. Only fear made you fall." And I remember that. What a wonderful teaching that was. You can actually just do scans of your neural networks. You can go to see psychologists. You can go and do a PhD. But what makes you fall in and fail? Only fear. Nothing else. On that same size of wood on the courtyard, he can just walk across that backwards, blindfolded, on his hands. Be no problem at all. But you say it's acid underneath. And that's the fear. That is what pushes you in. So this is the past and the future. Forget about the future. You don't know what's going to happen. But if you have fear, it's fear that's always going to make you fall and fail. So how can there be any fear when Ajahn Brahm is here? So in other words, doesn't matter, I'll be here when done. Actually, all the years we've had John Graham. How many years is that? 8 years? 9 years? About 9 years now. 10 years? Getting on a bit. But anyway, I've had no fatalities yet in this meditation retreat centre. We don't intend to start now. So you're perfectly safe. So understanding that means you don't need to worry about the future. You've got food coming tomorrow, or just in a couple of hours. You've got a nice place you can rest. Loved, cared for, safe. You're not going to be told off. You're not going to, it's not like one of these Zen retreats where they come round the back with a stick. We don't do things like that. It's very kind, very peaceful, very fun. Nothing to fear. That means you relax. Relax into this present moment. Do you understand? There's another old master story. The master told his disciple, or rather the disciple asked, "Have you any wise words?" And the master said, "Okay, my wise words for today, or actually you might say for this retreat, the wise words are, never argue with a fool." Don't argue with an idiot. And the disciple replied, "That's not compassionate." And the master replied, "Yeah, I agree with you." Do you agree? So anyway, come in the present moment. So when you're meditating, especially today, right now is the only time you ever have. It's the most important time in the whole world. It's the only time. Now, who is the most important person in the whole world? Is it the Buddha? No. Is it Ajahn Brahm? Is it the cook? Yes, I was going to say. They're really important. Is it a teddy bear? Is it yourself? No, it's not yourself. The most important, this is the great Leo Tolstoy. He said, the most important person in the whole world is the one right in front of you now. Whoever that happens to be. So you're the most important person in the world to me now. Because you're right in front of me. No, you're not. What it is, it brings you into this moment. The content of this moment, right now, is the most important thing in the whole world. So, how do you meditate? What are you supposed to be focusing on? What should you pay attention to? Whatever's in front of you right now, whatever that is important. Be with it. It's the most important experience in the whole world. Whatever's happening now. What do you do with it? Oh, I'm tired. Oh, I'm fed up. I am sick. I am demented. I am psychopathic. I don't know what else you are. So whatever it is, it's important. You're getting to know it. But what do you do with it? And the answer was to care for it. This beautiful little bit of loving kindness, compassion to whatever is happening now. And of course, the story behind this. I went to, this is a doctor over here in Perth. You know, I went to his, it wasn't actually his house, his friend's house for a dana a week ago. And his two kids are there. His parents were there. His wife was there. His mother-in-law and father-in-law visiting from Sri Lanka were there. But he wasn't there at all. And you know, his name was, I don't mind telling you, his name was Sumata. I said, where's Sumata? You know where he was? In Russia, watching the World Cup. The soccer. And all his wife and family and everyone was there except him. But anyway, but it shows he's a successful doctor. But he was a young man. And when he was a young man, he'd come to the temple. Just always any problems he had in life, you know, I'd try and sort them out for him. But the big problem he had was when he said, I've got to resign from being a doctor. Can't do it any longer. I said, well, you make a big mistake. Not a big mistake, but I just... It's too hard. Because what happened for him, he was the one who he was looking after. He's only an intern, I think, first year or two as a doctor. He lost his first patient in very tragic circumstances. It wasn't his fault, but you know, he didn't see the signs. It was this young woman, about 23, who died. And that was hard enough, you know, just... feeling he didn't see, you know, what maybe could have saved her life. But then he had to tell the news to this young lady's husband. You know, only been married a few years. They're still in the you might call it the idiocy, the craziness, you know, of love. You know, just, you know, love each other so much, depend upon each other so much. Have you seen, you know, your kids in love again? Oh, the most wonderful person in the world. I'm so lucky. You know, you know that. And you're still in that stage of love. And he had to tell this guy unexpectedly, the love of your life has died. If that wasn't hard enough, the two young children by his side. And your children have got no mummy. They're gone. And you can sort of get some idea of just how that felt to be the one who has to say that to the family. And it was unexpected. It was nothing, he didn't do anything wrong. No one could have done any better than him, but he lost that patient. Tragic circumstances. And I remember him coming to me in Nolamara Temple saying, Ajahn Brahm, I've got to see you. I've got to resign. I can't do this anymore. I can't face the prospect of having to do that again. It's just too painful. And that's when you told him the story of you've misunderstood why you're a doctor. The purpose, the main priority of being a doctor is not to cure people. Because any doctor is only a temporary cure at best. You just put off death for a few years. But thank goodness they come. And that's when people ask me, what's the definition of life in Buddhism? And this is actually not from the suttas. This is somebody else told me this. Life. Life is a sexually transmitted terminal disease. Think about it, it's true, isn't it? It's a sexually transmitted terminal disease. It's life. It's a bit negative, but I've been trying for years to try and find fault with that and can't. Anyway, say you're going to die. So, and if you really think your purpose is to cure, if that's the main priority, to cure at all costs, you know that happens in our modern system of health? Throw any resources to try and cure somebody, if you can afford it. Doesn't matter just how unpleasant or painful that must be. But, so there's something wrong with that. Your job is not to cure people. Your main job is to care for them. Just a change in English, there's only one letter difference, cure to care. If you want to try and cure someone, you'll be a failure many times in your career. Caring for somebody, you never ever need to feel a failure. You can always care for someone, no matter what. But to cure someone, sometimes it's beyond your abilities. Always care, not cure. Look at me as a teacher, trying to cure some of the monks and anagarikas. And I don't know, how long have I known some of you? Trying to cure you of your bad habits? Forget about it, Ajahn Brahm. I give up. I can still care for you. Now that's more important, caring, not curing. Now, so I said, that's more important, care, not cure. And he got it. He said also, if you make your life as a carer more important than curing people their diseases and their illnesses, you will always be successful. And number two, just as a byproduct, the extra little gift, not intended, but it happens, you'll probably cure many more people if you make caring more important than curing. And I think you can understand that. He's still a doctor. He's a great doctor. And, you know, he must be a good doctor, just he managed to find time to go off to Russia to watch the soccer. I don't know what team he was supporting, because you know, he was Sri Lankan, and Sri Lankan don't have a football team. You want to know why the reason why the Sri Lanka and other Buddhist countries don't have a football team that's successful? The reason is because they're too compassionate. I don't know about Indonesia, but you know, to tell, don't ever put any Buddhists in the soccer team for Indonesia. They always just let go. Let go of the ball, let somebody else have it. Anyway, so the caring, not curing. So, and that becomes the third thing, third answer. What's the most important thing to do is to care. Not to cure. Just ordinary in life, I don't know how many people have problems in marriages, or with kids, or with even your own body. And always try and cure people and cure things and cure your husband. There's lots of ladies here. Take it from me. I'm an expert in marriages. You will never be able to cure your husband of his bad habits. You will always be able to care for him. And by caring for him, you'll find he cures himself. You can't cure your wife, but you can care for her. And that's when the relationship starts to become wonderful. Your body, cure it. How about trying to care for it? If you care for your body, how does it feel now? Do you need to actually to sit on a chair? Care for it. Try and cure it so you know you can sit for 10 hours on broken glass, you know, on the hard concrete. So that doesn't work. That's just ego. Caring is more selfless. Looking after your body. When you need to rest, please rest. especially the first few days. And then the meditation starts to kick in. So the caring is more important. So that's the Emperor's three questions. Now is the most important time. The one in front of you, the most important person in the whole world, the most important thing to do is to care. What's that got to do with meditation? What are you aware of right now? Now, it's the most important meditation object in the world. What do I do? Care for it. If you try to get rid of it, try to make it better, make it, that's more curing instead of caring. I got to cure my mind of its defilements. Stop thinking too much. Stop being restless. Stop being so tired and sleepy. I've only got 8 or 9 days. I want to get enlightened. I've got many things to do when I go back. So instead of trying to cure yourself of its bad mind states, care for them. It's beautiful loving kindness. Right now. You find what happens is, number one, it means you can meditate at any time, anywhere, with any state of body or mind. Actually, where I developed this from was when some people said, well, look, you know, I'm sick, I'm in hospital, I'm in pain, you know, but I can't watch my breath. What should I do? I said, of course you can meditate. You don't need to be sitting full lotus. You know, you're laying on a bed. So really sick. And, well, what should I do? What time is it? Now, if you want to know about that, you can go into the meditation rooms over there. I demonstrated that the first day. The walking meditation over there, it's got a clock in there. You can actually change the clock hands. So I think I changed it to lunchtime. Still lunchtime. Okay. So look at the clocks in the room over there. Oh, it's lunchtime. So go get some lunch, even though it's the middle of the night. But no. So now's the only time. So what are you aware of right now? Are you hungry? Are you fed up? Are you tired? Are you cold? What are you feeling right now? Now is the most important thing. What's happening right now? Any of you sick, in bed, in hospital? Now is the most important time. What does it feel like right now? And you care for it. Not afraid of it, not try to get rid of it. You care for it. And my goodness, the amount of amazing things I've seen happen in my own body and other people's bodies when you follow that method. That goes to the heart of meditation. Because when you're caring for this, you're not trying to get rid of it. There's no ill will, no pushing away, none of the second hindrance, none of the first hindrance wanting something. You're right there in this moment, learning from this moment. It might be unpleasant, but it's much less unpleasant when you care for something than when you try and get rid of it. Or when you want something more, or want something different. You're right here. And just learning from this. And it passes pretty quickly. When you don't fight it, you're caring for it. And then, because you're not wasting so much energy, the amount of energy we waste, I don't mean in our body, I mean in our head. I think I did actually see this in a Science magazine, I think it's like 23-24%, if I remember the number correctly, the percentage of your energy which is used in your brain. Your brain, compared to its size, consumes more energy than anything else in your body, than any other organ. And I don't eat that much, but because my brain now is so efficient, it doesn't think that much, it meditates. Because my brain doesn't use nearly a fraction of the energy it usually would do, That means I've got so much surplus energy. Which is where this comes from. If I could only learn how to worry some more and to think some more, then I would lose weight, like you guys. But the brain does take up so much energy. So you can just imagine what would happen if you didn't fight, you cared. You didn't worry about the future. You didn't worry about the past. But you just cared for this moment. What would happen is you become energized instead of tired. Depression, which is just exhaustion of the brain, would start to disappear. You'd wake up energized. Just because that simple, now the most important time, this moment the most important, just being here and being kind. The brain energizes. When it energizes, your sloth and torpor, your tiredness disappears. You're awake, alive, here. Not only that, but you start to get happy. The energy is joy. The joy makes you energized. Sometimes some people, they need a cup of coffee in the morning. Without that coffee, they're miserable. You wouldn't even want to talk to them until they've had their first cup of coffee or tea. They need a boost of energy. But once you're energized, especially with natural energy, you're happy. Because you're happy, it's easier to be here. You don't need to go anywhere else. Because now, right here is beautiful and wonderful. So, this is not a second-class meditation. This is not, I just do this at the beginning, and later on I'm going to the real stuff. Watching the breath. Lights, come on, that was the real stuff. But no, this gets to the heart of the meditation. Now the most important time. See how much you can be here right now. The most important person or thing is what is right in front of you now. And what to do just to care for it. So what happens if you're thinking thoughts and fantasies and planning what you're going to do next? If it's right in front of you right now, it's important. Be aware of it. And care for it. Oh, it's all right, mind. If you want to think like that, that's fine. You know what happens? Oh, many of those thoughts is just like an agitation of the mind. When you don't add to that agitation, the thoughts, they just stop. I'll say it later on about the anger-eating monster, but that's a wonderful simile. If you don't give it anger, get out of your stupid thoughts, get out of your tiredness, get out of your restlessness. That's what feeds it. Being kind to it. I just like you want to think, that's fine. Yeah, it's fine. And then it can't last so long. You're peaceful, you're happy, and you are still. Meditation is very easy when you don't try to meditate, when you're not looking to get somewhere, when you're right here in this moment. This is the most important object in the whole world, and you just care for it. And I did mention this to the first group of people, that to help you be in the present moment and to develop kindness. We have, to my right, my disciples, many of them, just sitting, actually quite a lot of them, go, they're gone. You've got one over here. Still a few left. Do you take them back to your room? Please bring them here as well. You got one there. Oh, they're on the other side. Oh, I can't see them. But please, if you haven't got a teddy bear yet, take a teddy bear, you put it in your lap, and it reminds you of the present moment. Now is the most important time. You're right here, and you're caring. And you find it does make the meditation much, much more effective. It works. And that's one of the reasons I was saying, just mentioning it to you in passing. I just got an email last night from the publisher in Wisdom, and it was, you know, from the German edition. You got the three of my books are in the top 10 bestseller in Germany. Spirituality. The Good, Bad, Who Knows, and the Opening the Door of Your Heart, and the new one, I think it's number 4 or something, is Bear Awareness. Now, the Bear Awareness. I think you have that in, Haneke called it Bear Meditation, didn't he?
Yes.
Bear Meditation. Have you got a Chinese translation of that yet, Della? Bear Awareness? Bear Meditation? Not yet. And one day. Live in the present moment. It's good enough. So anyway, that's the bear book. That's where it came from. Getting the bear and learning how to meditate with a bear. So it's very popular. So, there's a few bears left. I've been told by my contacts on Wall Street, it's a bear market. No bull. Shit. Okay, so there we go. That's the talk for today, just this morning, all about now the most important time. Whatever's right in front of you, the most important person or thing, and to care. Very good. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Excellent. Okay. So have a wonderful morning. If you're still tired and jet lagged, there's always this wonderful bed in your room. You can meditate in there. Flat out. Or if you want to do some walking meditation or have a cup of tea, just have a walk around. Have a smell of the food. I'm sure it'll be very delicious. And the meal is at 11 o'clock. That's right, isn't it? Over here? 11. My meal is over there at 10:30 because there's people coming. Is it 11 o'clock lunchtime? For you guys?
Yes, 11 o'clock.
11 o'clock, thereabouts, yeah. But again, just like breakfast, It's they're free and easy, it is obligatory. You don't have to have lunch. I don't want to force it on you. I don't want to compel you. So have a wonderful morning.